Welcome, everyone. Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. The 8111 contingent is going to come up here and do the readings. Is it Maria that's going to start off? Maria is going to start off with how it works.
My name is Maria, and I am an alcoholic. And this is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot and will not completely give themselves to the simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living that demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil, until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help... Oh, God. It is too much for us. But there's... There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Have measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a fearless, a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. Many of us exclaim, "What? An order? I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to go along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
Thanks, Diane. Hi, family. My name is Annette, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm nervous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are betrusted in servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, accepting in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems or lest problems or of problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as thought ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relation policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and film. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, a reminder us to place principles before personalities. Thanks.
Good evening. My name is Paige. I'm an alcoholic. And these are the ninth step promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. And we will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly. They will materialize, always materialize, if we work for them. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for reading. And we've got one last reading. It's based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in their personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has actually happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too, I must have this thing. Lili G has come from 8111, and she was recommended by Anna Kay, who spoke here November, December time frame, and what an incredible story that was, and I'm really looking forward to hearing some more from this same home group where Anna came from. Welcome, Lili.
Wow. Hey, I'm Lili. I'm an alcoholic. You're a bunch of good-looking drunks. Wow. I'm going to read one little thing out of the Big Book before I tell my story, because I like to start with the most difficult and most impossible promise for me. And it's in Chapter 7, Working with the Others. It says, frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is a bright spot of our lives. That seemed impossible to me. I absolutely despised AA when I started. However, that's changed. And I'm a little nervous. Y'all bear with me. I'll tell a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I have had a spiritual awakening in this program that is more amazing than anything that I could ever imagine. I was born in 74 in Marietta, Georgia, born and raised, to a 16-year-old mother and 17-year-old father who met at spring break and were made to get married because 9 months later there I was. And daddy went off to the army and mom was a very active hippie, alcoholic / drug addict or, you know, whatever. For me, looking back on life, it seemed pretty normal until I came into AA. I was born Michael Lee. That's what my mother did to me. And so from the time I was born, I was already different. And I can remember, you know, people saying, hey, what's your name, Michael? And the looks would be Michael. You know, and so from a very, very young age, I knew something was wrong with me already, you know, and thanks, Mom, you know. 1977, a few years later, when I was 3 years old, my father was murdered, and my mom became a single mom of me and my younger brother by that time. And, you know, being uneducated, dropping out of school, getting married, I guess never imagined that Daddy was going to die, who was the provider. And she was off on her own. When my father passed, my mom had a very difficult time, and I went to Harlem, New York, with my godmother, who was a very, very, very loving black woman that was my mother's best friend growing up. But that's where I learned I was even more different. I was the maybe one of three white people in the neighborhood that I lived in. And, again, very different, picked on. You know, as far back as I can remember, just did not fit in my own skin. I cringed. I wanted to be different than what I was. You know, I lived in Harlem up until... I was three then until I was 6 years old. And I remember coming home from school one day and Miss Brenda, who I called Mama by then, said, Mikey, I have to tell you something. You know, your real mom's coming to get you this weekend and take you back to Georgia. And you talk about balked. I didn't know this woman. I didn't want to go. And I pitched a fit so bad that she actually moved down here with me and my mother and my two god brothers. And that was in 1981, and I got picked on even more. I got picked on for the way I talked funny. I got picked on for wearing funny clothes. I mean, everything that could be wrong with a person was wrong with me, and I was only six, you know. So you know, I just remember being not fitting in from as far back as I can remember. Fast forward, you know, eventually I got used to, my surroundings, accepting, you know, it kind of grows on you after a while. Moving to, back to Marietta, Georgia, in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And also moving into a lower income neighborhood, being a minority was, again, I was different, picked on, called everything but my name, you know. And so I started figuring out that there were some things I could do to make me feel a little better. So one was go by my middle name, which was Lee. Eventually Lee. I don't know where that came from, but it happened over the years. So I was just a little bit more cool. I stopped getting picked on for my name. And then, you know, I can remember I got picked on for wearing funny clothes. My mom couldn't afford a whole lot. So I'd go steal. You know, very, very young. Elementary, middle school, I was stealing clothes so that I'd be just a little cooler. A little less picked on. And then I remember in sixth grade I got in my first fight, and I was petrified. And I think out of pure fear, I beat the crap out of that little girl. And and so I got a little cooler, you know. So I beat up the bully. You know, and I don't know how, because I was petrified of this girl. So I started learning really early that you have to do these bad things and get cool, you know. 1985, I got my first little charge, 11, 12 years old, and went to juvenile. I got charged with runaway. You know, they gave me a week or two to think about it. And, you know, juvenile was a lot worse than home, so I guess I'll go back to Mom's, you know. And, you know, the next year, 1986, I had my first drink, and that I can remember anyway. And I remember very vividly, it was seventh grade. It was four wine coolers, and I blacked out, and I loved it. I didn't love the way it tasted. I did not love the way it smelled, but I absolutely loved the way I felt. And however, the next day I didn't feel so good, and I didn't love it quite so much. And then I didn't know I blacked out until the next day when they were telling me some of the stupid things that I was doing. And I really didn't believe them. I was like, no, I didn't remember that. And they were very adamant, like, yeah, Lee, yes, you did. And so, you know, I was like, well, I had this headache, and I felt like crap, and I'm never going to drink again. You know, by this time, Mom's drinking a whole lot, too, and I just absolutely was repulsed by it, and I would never, ever be like her, you know, ever. Needless to say, a year later, it took me another year to drink, but it was the same thing. Four wine coolers, blacked out again, and I got in a fight, back to juvenile, second time to juvenile. And, you know, I think it was like 2 weeks then, you know, and 2 weeks is a long time for a little 13-year-old, you know, like, oh my God, I'm doing life. My option was to go home and go to counseling and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I kind of told the judge, well, you know, she needs to do something about her drinking, you know. And I remember going home from that, and my mom has one of these, you know, one eyebrow up looks that I knew that if I ever mentioned alcohol again, especially in a court setting or around anything similar, that this was going to be bad consequences. So we never mentioned alcohol for a while again. And then it wasn't long later before my third time to juvenile for shoplifting. And the judge told me, he said, you got one more time to come in my court, and I'm going to commit you to the state, which is like the children's prison, you know. And I wasn't willing to do that because, you know, that's like a year or more, you know, and that was just, you know, I wasn't going to do that. And I think I was about 13. So then, you know, I had this bright idea. Well, I'll just have a baby, and I can get away from her. And at age 14, I was pregnant with my first son. And it wasn't an accident. I tried very hard. You know, this is just the start of the insane thinking, just to let you know. I'm going to have this baby, and I can get away from Mom, and there's nothing she can do about it. And then I had an ultimatum from Mom. You have an abortion or you get out of my house. See ya. That's the best thing I could have heard. Until I had to get out there, and it was tough, you know. So, you know, I remember having my son. I turned 15 by the time I gave birth to him. And for the first time in my life, I had done something right. I looked at something so perfect and so amazing, and I did it, you know. And so, you know, fast forward, you know, I'm this young mother, you know, finally Mom, you know, is kind of warming up to this cool little grandbaby and, you know, invites me back home and, you know, all this good stuff. And so, of course, I went back. It was a whole lot easier to finish school being at Mom's house, you know. And so I did, went back to my mom's, cleaned it up, wasn't going to drink because I was this mom and I was going to show my mom how to be a good mom. So, needless to say, I did stay in school senior year. It took me to my senior year to drink again. And that drink led to a lot more drinks and led to being pregnant with twins from somebody that I had really did not know. Had just met. I was drunker and I don't know what. And pregnant with twins senior year. So here we go. Of course, Mom's like, well, you know, you need to think about your kids and you need to marry this man and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, if you like him so much, why don't you marry him? And, needless to say, I got married to this man, and I was in high school and it was really cool because, you know, I got to sign my own report cards, you know, I got to sign my own permission slips and I got to skip school with my own, you know, my own little slip saying I'm excused, you know, so it was really, really a cool thing. But it was tough, you know. I don't know, only by the grace of God that I finished high school. I have no clue how that happened. I don't even remember high school that much. But, you know, fast forward, you know, and this is very difficult because one of my children are here. And, but When my oldest son was 18 months old, I walked in on the babysitter molesting him, and it was very tough. But I shot him, and I shot him in the leg. I didn't kill him, but I got charged with attempted murder, and I was 16, and I got charged as an adult, and so life started really being unfair, and God, how dare you, and you have really turned your back on me, and how could you do this, and don't they understand, and, you know, I told the judge I wasn't trying to kill him, I was just trying to shoot something off, and the judge didn't like that too much, and I did 1 year. I pled out to aggravated assault or some crap, and I had 16 years probation, and I did a year as a 16-year-old in adult penitentiary, and so then I became very, very angry. I was already angry, but then I was aware of my anger. I had a lot of anger, my mother, all these outside people, my husband, because he's the one that suggested this babysitter, and it was all his fault, and, you know, all these things were everybody else's fault, and, you know, I just felt betrayed by God. I really did. Fast forward to 93, you know, I graduated. I moved to Michigan with my now ex-husband, but at that time my husband, and I had my fourth son, and at 3.5 weeks old, he was killed by a drunk driver in a car accident, and so, yeah, I'm really PO'd at God, you know, and ironically, that kicked in a next level of alcoholism for me. I like to say I'm the ABC alcoholic, absolute vodka, Budweiser beer, and Coke, and it's not a cola. And that was what fixed all my problems. I didn't have to think about how bad life was. I didn't have to think about any pain. I didn't have to feel any pain. I just drank every single night and did other things too, but mostly my liquor was a real good thing. I'm going to fast forward a little bit. By the time, by 1998, I had 6 children. They were all boys, and 6 boys, just a real mess. I had my first intervention, and it was because I had stolen some stuff from my mother, and this time she caught me, and so I went and pawned it and all this stuff, and so we had these 2 next door neighbors that came and talked to me and, you know, was telling me about AA, and I'm like, I'm not an alcoholic, she is, you know, you need to take her to AA, you know, still my mom, you know. But needless to say, by that time I had a nice little defect case, you know, they're coming to visit me and they're suggesting maybe 12 steps would be a good idea. And I had a couple of judges that were saying, you know, maybe AA is a good idea. And I had mom and these friggin' next door neighbors saying, maybe AA is a good idea. So, you know what, to shut everybody up, I'll go. And so, November 1998 was my first AA meeting at a place in Marietta called Rebo's. My first meeting was a speaker meeting. And some guy named Bill, I don't know anything else about him, but his name was Bill. And he told my story from cities to clubs to stuff we did to the way I felt. This man told my story, and he was umpteen years sober, and I'm like, yeah, he wasn't an alcoholic like me then, you know, because nobody would go that long without drinking or drugging. There's just no way, especially not the drinking, you know, because, see, that's still legal, you know. Needless to say, I kind of liked that meeting. It was kind of cool, and people kind of looked happy. Y'all were hugging, and that was kind of weird because the guys were hugging the guys too, and that was really weird. And then, you know, all these people were just happy and loving AA, and I just didn't get it. But I decided to go the next day, which was Sunday morning, spiritual meeting. Yeah, the same guy, Bill, was up at the little, you know, microphone thing. I don't even know if they had microphones back then, but I know we were smoking back then. And, and this guy said out of his mouth, he said, "Man, this is great. Where else can you go smoke cigarettes, cuss, and talk about God all at the same time?" And I'm like, yeah, I'm in the right place. Beats the heck out of church, you know. So, I don't remember much about what was being said because they were talking a lot about the G word, and I didn't want to hear the G word because the G word had turned his back on me. But, you know, it was kind of nice being in there and, you know, all these nice, friendly, hugging people were back again. And so, you know, it was kind of cool. Third meeting, big book. So I look around the room, I'm looking for this Bill guy, you know. And I see him, and he's sitting at the table, and he's got his big book out, and he's got his highlighter, and his big book looks like a dog on Christmas tree. There's so many colors and stuff marked up. And I said, "Hey, dude, like, what in the world could you be highlighting after 25 years sober? I mean, really?" And he explained to me that the more you read it, the more pops out at you, you know. And fast forward, yeah, I get that. But at that time, I was like, golly, boy. However, I don't remember what chapter we were on. I don't remember it making any sense. But I do remember saying, I heard some stuff about Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob and, you know, these cool people that, you know, helped us. And I asked this guy, I was like, "Hey, are you Bill Wilson?" And the whole... Yeah, that's what the whole people at the table today laughed. And so that was my ticket to not go back because, you know, they were laughing at me, you know, and how dare they? You know, I don't know who Bill Wilson is, and I don't know who this guy is. And so that didn't last very long. I did go to a couple of more meetings, and they were open discussion. And that's when I realized I was not in the right place because you guys were talking some crap that I did not understand. You know, and plus self-knowledge, I'm just saying. I got enough of that stuff that y'all were talking about that, hey, I mean, I haven't drank in a week. I got it. You know, I got this. Needless to say, 1999, back to prison. I don't even remember what charge that was. But, it was AA in prison because, you know, I could get out of the dorm. I didn't have to sit in that cell. So, yeah, we'll go to AA, you know. Did AA for whatever, a year, whatever I was in there for. Get out, go drink, you know. 2001, back in prison, you know. And ironically, or by the grace of God, who knows, I've never had a drug charge or a DUI. But, boy, I went to jail and prison a whole lot for the things I was indirectly doing. My brain made it make sense to break the law because it was also a quick fix for me, you know. If I need money, go steal it. You know, you need some clothes, go steal it. You know, blah, blah, blah. Just, you know, who cares about the law? Don't you know how unjust the law is? What did they do with my son and me? You know, who cares about the law? So, AA, in prison again, 2001, out, drunk again, you know. Finally, I did go to prison for my fourth time in 2002, and by this time I was starting to get tired of it. And here's the thing, I'd heard about powers over alcohol, I kind of could buy that, but, 25, 30 times to jail and my life wasn't unmanageable because if the police would just leave me alone, you know, I'd be fine, you know, I just was delusional. However, in 2002, I was getting a little tired, so I decided to try to, like, really go to AA. And for some reason, I knew there was a solution in there. I finally got to the point where, okay, maybe all these people are not lying, you know, because I really thought y'all were full of it for a while. And so I did. I went to AA, and I started actually asking the lady, who ironically, I found out later, is a member of 8111 that would go to Cobb County Jail on Sundays and carry the message into AA. And, so I was like, you know, what am I doing wrong? You know, just give me an assignment, you know. What do I do? And she would tell me, go read the doctor's opinion like three times. I'm like, what? But I do it, you know, because she made that little sentence, willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. She'd say that over and over again. I'd say, yeah, but, you know, I wasn't really. I just wanted to sound real good so she'd give me an assignment, you know. It was better to read the big book than the Bible in jail, you know, and that's kind of what we do. In 2004, I got out, you know, whenever, and again, got out, drank. Somewhere in the midst of that, I caught an escape charge somewhere in those years, and I was on the run, and this one was pretty scary because you talk about paranoia, it will mess your drinking up being on the run, you know, because you're always looking for the police. And I just remember, you know, I didn't know then, but I know now, that March 3rd, 2004, I pick up the telephone. I was in a hotel room drinking and drugging myself to death. And I couldn't stop, you know, and I'd cry and I'd look at my kids' pictures and who had lost all six of them by then. And matter of fact, one of the six had given up for adoption during a sentence, you know. I was in prison. The person that adopted him was a police officer who happened to be my sister. you know, when you show up to court in a blue suit with a badge versus a blue suit with state prisoner on the back, it kind of goes in their favor. And so she adopted my three-month-old son. And I was real angry. How dare you, you know, take my kid? You know, because it's still everybody else's fault. And the whole world was wronging me. So anyways, you know, March 3rd, 2004, I was in this hotel in Marietta, and I was just crying. And at that point, the alcohol was not working anymore, you know, because I didn't cry when I didn't feel. And I'm staring at my kids' pictures, and I'm staring at a significant other. By this time, I'm divorced, and I'm actually with a woman because, you know, guys sucked. And she was not one of us, rarely ever drank, and decided to drink and drive and killed herself. And so then now there's two people in my life very close to me that have died an alcoholic death that weren't alcoholics, you know. So only by the grace of God, it scared the crap out of me to drink and drive. Thank God. I think I probably did that maybe twice. But, you know, I was really scared of that because it was not something on the news that happened in real life for me. And so I'm grateful for that now. March 3rd, 2004, I called my parole officer. And I said, hey, dude, I'm at Howard Johnson, and I really need you to come get me in the next 30 minutes because if you don't, I'm going to go get some more. And I need help, you know. I was like, I cannot stop. And he said, well, Miss Gore, don't you know we can take you to jail? I was like, man, you've done that my whole life. It's not working. I need help, you know. Jail's not cutting it. And so, you know, he came in 25 minutes. you know, he sat and he talked to me. And, you know, I'm crying and I'm drunk and high and just a mess, and he says, I'm going to take you to the Cobb County Jail, and you got 30 days to find your program. Well, that was new, because, you know, I've been to prison by this time 3 or 4 times. I've been to jail over 25 times, diversion center, boot camp, you know, transition, wherever these people can send you, I've been. But I hadn't been to rehab, you know. It never dawned on me that maybe that might be the answer. And so I go back to Cobb County Jail, and knowing that I have 30 days to find a program to get into. He was really nice and dropped my escape charge, absconding, because I turned myself in, you know. And but having that charge made it very difficult to get into some of these programs because I was a flight risk. And I started getting nervous. Needless to say, I started working with this lady again from 8111, which I didn't know about 8111 at that time. I just know it was this cool lady, Lynn, that came into Cobb County Jail, you know, me thinking she's just this great lady, you know, that was bored, and, you know. But I was glad she was there, and she'd say, Lily, what are you doing back? And I'm like, Lynn, I just missed you. And, you know. But this time, you know, I was broken. I was broken. And, you know, I'd gone in that AA that time and very ashamed and embarrassed, You know, which was the first time I really felt that way about my drinking and drugging and the consequences that came behind it, which was losing all my children. And I say lose, but really my actions, I gave them away, you know. But at that point, it was still, I lost everything, you know. And she gave me some assignments, you know. And are you powerless over alcohol? Is your life unmanageable? Yes! Finally, yes, it is, you know. And then 2 and 3, I'm not there yet. Not there yet. I don't even know how to pray. And so she told me, she said, for 1 week, I want you for three minutes a day, three times a day, just thank God. And I said, Lynn, I don't have that much to be thankful for, you know. She says, do it anyway. And all right, and sometimes 3 minutes seems like 3 hours when you're praying and you don't know what you're praying to, or for me anyway. But I sit there and I watch the little hand go around the clock and I'd be like, thank you that I'm alive. Thank you that I'm alive. And thank you that I'm alive. And, you know, all these other things. Thank you that I'm alive. Because I couldn't think of anything that I was grateful for, but I was willing to go to any length at this point, I thought. And so if I had to pray in order to do step two, then I will do it. And I did. And halfway through there, maybe day four of praying, I remember, you know, Cobb County has their windows painted over, I think because the guys and girls flash each other or something, I'm not sure. But there was one little piece of paint chipped off. And I put my little eyeball up to it, and I could see all the sky and these trees and these two little birds, like, did some funny thing. And I laughed, and I remember saying, thank you, God. And it wasn't time to pray. And I'm like, oh, what's she doing to me? Yeah, I was so proud of myself. I couldn't wait to go back and tell her, you know. And also, I couldn't wait to go back and tell her because I knew next week I get to pray for me. And so, which I wasn't allowed to do. She made that very clear. So at the end of that week, she says, okay, make a list of what you really want to ask God. Well, at that point, I had one son that was still in foster care. My family came to the rescue. This one was a little difficult, and my prayer was for him to get out of there. And then, you know, 2 weeks into this thing, I'm praying that I can get into rehab because, you know, these people are telling me no. You know, those are my two biggest concerns at that point. So I'm just, you know, praying for peace. You know, I'm writing this little list of things I want for me. And she says, the person you hate the most, go pray that God gives that to him. I was like, no way. God's going to know I'm lying. Mm-mm. She said, do it anyway. I'm like, okay. And so just so happened that there's a chick in jail with me who also has the name Lily that I didn't like because she stole my car when we were on the streets, and I was living a lifestyle that you couldn't call and report it stolen because, you know, then the police are going to come, you know. So you have to just say, okay, that's a gone car, you know. And and so anyways, I had to pray for this lady that I despised to get all this good stuff, you know. So I'm like, God, let Lily's kids be okay and let Lily get rehab and let Lily be at peace and let Lily live. I do that 3 minutes, three times a day for a week. Wasn't happy about that. Day four, I'm crying. I'm on the phone, you know. Another rehab turned me down because I was a flight risk. And I'm like, God, I'm going to prison because nobody will take me. And I come and I'm crying. And out of all the people in the world, Lily comes up to me and hands me a number. And says, Bridge of the Hope. She said, give them a call. And I did, and they accepted me in. And I'm like, wow, this is weird. This God thing, praying thing is working. Weird. And the next day, my mother got my son out of foster care. And so, you know, it's time for me to go make the list, and I can pray for me, and I didn't have anything to pray for. And she said, we'll just go back to thanking him. So that was my first little experience that maybe a higher power. We're not going to use the G word yet, but the higher power can restore me to sanity, just maybe. Just maybe, because those were kind of weird, you know. And so fast forward, you know, I go to this place called Bridges of Hope, and I'm all happy and excited, and it's down in the boonies. And
you know, I was excited about being there, but I still had a bad attitude. Very, very, very bad attitude, chip on my shoulder. You know, don't you guys know who I am? I haven't drank in a month. You know, and, you know, I know this big book because I've been going through it with this lady in Cobb County Jail. And, you know, I was really setting out to prove to you guys this was BS because I didn't believe it. And I read it. I read dictionary and words and the whole thing, you know. I didn't have a sponsor in jail. I had this one lady that worked with me for an hour. Well, not even that, you know, part of that hour. And, but I did what she told me to do. And so, anyways, I go to Bridges of Hope, and I've got this horrible attitude. And one of my consequences, well, here's the thing. She says, you need to share in every meeting. I was like, that's not how AA goes, because AA, you know, and Maria, they tell you to shut the heck up and listen and don't share because you don't know anything about staying sober. And don't you know that's how you're supposed to do it, because that's what I was taught. She says, you're going to talk at every meeting. And I was not happy about that because I was very shy, very petrified of people in AA. You guys scared the crap out of me. And so I raised my hand. I said, you know, it's kind of a cool place. And, you know, no, I said it's a cool program. I really like AA and I hate this place. And boy, did I get in trouble for that. And I had a consequence called the fence line, which means this 3 acres or whatever, which, you know, to a city slicker is a whole town and of trees and weeds. And I had to go on this fence line and pick weeds. I was like, all right, no biggie, you know. Not to mention, it's like 95 degrees outside. I'm out there in a tank top, burnt to crisp because, you know, no suntan lotion, no sunblock, and I'm picking these weeds. And I sit on this bucket, and she comes in a little CB, no, get off the bucket. I'm like, all right, well, I sat on my butt, start picking weeds. She says, get off your butt. I'm like, now she's effing with me, and I don't like it. You know, this lady's picking on me, and that's what I'm used to. And don't you know, I'm going to rebel. But I did it, and I bent over for hours and picked these doggone weeds. And I remember looking up, and I said, God, if you're up there, you'll send me a breeze. And guess what happened? The sun came out from behind a cloud, and it got about 5 degrees hotter. And and I looked at the sky and I said, dude, you got jokes. And at that, yeah. And at that point, a breeze came. A breeze came. It was not a windy day. It was very hot, very dry, very, you know, almost in Florida. I'm not used to that. But I knew for that moment that this God thing had spoke to me, you know. It wasn't my brain. Something happened. I can't wait to go back and tell them I've had a spiritual experience. You know, the white light, you know, has come to me. And don't you know who I am? Just like Bill Wilson, I had the moment, okay? About a month later, I was kicked out for my bad attitude. And I didn't drink, but I was kicked out because my attitude had not changed. So, you know, whatever. You know, I'm going to go out on the streets, and I'm going to do the right thing, and I get a little job, and ended up, I forgot this part. I had a daughter while I was in jail, and she passed away while I was at Bridges of Hope. And so now I'm back to being angry at God. You know, you do this to me when I'm sober. How dare you? Blah, blah, blah. So this is the second child gone, and I'm really, really, really not trying to hear the God thing. Fast forward about a month after getting kicked out, I get in a fight and I'm back in prison. Sober. Well, not sober, but dry. Clean, whatever you call it. I don't know. But I haven't worked the steps other than 1, 2, 3. I thought what I've realized later is that, you know, made a decision. See, I had this little comfort zone, which was, you know, I made a decision. But I didn't have to give my will and life up yet. I just had to make the decision to. Well, I found out later you got to go through the rest of the steps, you know. But I was like, oh, I made a decision. I'll do it later, you know. But decision's made, so I've done the step. Back in prison, all right, for violation or parole or whatever. They're fed up with me, and at this point I'm fed up with them. But I had my big book with me, you know. So I'm going to take my big book to prison, you know, because I knew that was the only way that I was going to stop going, you know, because I finally came to understand that it was my consequences. And so I wrote the parole board and asked for a program called CRC or CRA, something like that, Correctional Recovery Academy. It's very strict, very intense 12-step program, and I got it. And boy, let me tell you, whoo, I went through the steps, and I just want to quickly say, you know, that 1, 2, 3, you know, we kind of redid those. I did the most fearless and thorough 4-step that I could imagine doing because I was scared to death to drink again. At that point in time, I understood for me to drink was to die. So I did a 4-step. And then you got to tell this to somebody? Okay, well, I'm in a place with 2,000 inmates and they're women. And it's not happening. And then there's this little place in the book that says it might be a doctor, psychologist, something like that. I'm like, yeah, the jail psychiatrist. He knows me. And I'm sure he's heard worse than my crap. So I went to him and I asked him, you know, I said, do you know anything about the 12 steps? He says, yeah. I said, do you know anything about the 5th step? He says, yeah. I said, can I do it with you? And his exact word to me was, I'll be honored. And when I read the big book and it says, if you explain to them, this is life or death, you know, they would be honored. And I thought, ooh, that was my confirmation. You know, I've picked the right person. So I go through the 5th step. It was like 33 pages front and back. I mean, it was just outrageous. But I went back to as far as I can remember anything that might just made me mad. If I wasn't sure if it was resentment, it went on there. Because I was scared to drink again. And so I did the 5th with him, and then I went through, you know, a few more steps. I made as many amends as I could from, you know, prison. You can't make a whole lot. But, you know, I wrote a lot of letters, and I never said I was sorry. I said, I understand that I caused a lot of fear and pain, and I owned it. And I didn't say I was sorry, because my family has heard that. My friends have heard that my whole life. So I just said, what I'm doing today is different than what I've ever done, and I'm trying to live better, you know. And I asked for their forgiveness. I didn't say I forgive them. I had to tell my little lady that I was working with that I forgive them. But because I did, she suggested, don't say you're forgiving them, because that's saying they did something wrong to you. I was like, okay. She said, but forgive them anyway, you know. And so I did as many as I could when I got out, and I was released. January 9th, 2006, and I remember, okay, I'm not going to go get drunk today. And they give me a little token. I was at Metro Transitional Center, and they give me a little MARTA token. And they send me on my way, and I remember asking, like, I said, hey, do you know where an AA meeting is? And I'm whispering because I don't want anybody to hear. And he said, yeah, and he told me how to get to Dunwoody Station, I don't know, and get on the A7 and just tell the bus driver that you want to go to 8111. And I didn't know what 8111 was. I never heard of 8111, but I did what he said. And I was like, hey, and I'm whispering, like, hey, do you know what 8111 is? He was like, yeah. I was like, I need to go there. He's like, okay. I'm like, okay, cool. And then until we pull up at 8111, he comes on the intercom, 8111. I'm like, oh, God. That's my stop. Yeah. So much for anonymity, huh? but you know, here's the thing. I went to this meeting called Sober Sisters. It was like 10 o'clock. I'm like 2 hours fresh out of prison. And I am excited, you know? I actually wanted to be there for the first time at any AA meeting. I wanted to be there. And I saw, 5 minutes, okay. I saw this lady, Lynn, sitting in a corner. And I shared, and she cried. She said, that's why I do what I do, you know. I stayed sober about 3 years, and I picked up, you know. And I picked up one. And I know it's crazy sounding. I picked up one. My ego said, you can do just one. But I went right back the next day and picked up a white chip because I was so embarrassed and ashamed of myself for drinking one. But somewhere along the line, you know, I loved AA so much that I thought I was sober. Then I didn't smash the idea that one day, somehow, some way, I would drink normally. And fast forward 3 more years sober, I picked up again. And at that point, I was out for 2 days and I could not stop. And some friends of mine from 8111 came and got me. And December 7th, I picked up another white chip, and I surrendered to this program, and I smashed the idea that I could ever, ever, ever drink again. I went through all 12 steps thoroughly with my sponsor. They didn't fire me because I, you know, messed up. That was my biggest fear. Like, oh, my God, where am I going to find another sponsor? She stuck with me. She's the biggest blessing in my life. What I realized is I would choke on the 12th step, you know? And I thought because I had this spiritual experience that, you know, I was all that. But what happened going through the 12 steps is I had a spiritual awakening. And God, I love saying God now. God is the reason I'm here right now. God is the reason why I got all six of my kids back, including the one that I gave up for adoption. This is just 2 or 3 months ago. God is the reason why everything in my life is good. And I don't choke on the 12th step. I work with other alcoholics. They keep me sober. I don't keep them sober. I do a lot of service work. Not because I have to anymore, because I actually like it. I like you people. And you are the bright spot of my life now. And I'm just going to read my favorite passage out of the big book, and I'm going to be done. But being in jail and prison, and they tell you to read personal stories, freedom from bondage kind of sticks out. The word freedom looks real good when you're locked up. I read that story, and I believe the lady knew me. And here's the thing. Page 553 of the third edition, it says, the only real freedom a human being can ever know is doing what you ought to do because you want to do it. This great experience that released me from the bondage of hatred and replaced it with love is really just another affirmation of the truth I know, that I get everything I need in Alcoholics Anonymous, everything I need I get, and when I get what I need, I invariably find that it was just what I wanted all the time. Thank you so much for helping me stay sober tonight.
That was AA amazing. Tinsley, could you come hand out the chips?
My name is Tinsley. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, Lily. That was a great story. Here at this meeting, we have a chip system to mark our time away from our last drink. If you want to try this way of life one day at a time, we offer a white chip. Anybody like a white chip? After 30 days, we have a silver chip. Anybody got 90 days, red chip? Anybody got 6 months, yellow chip? No sudden moves. green chip, 9 months. Any birthdays?
I will. I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. You see that thing? You go, I'm not going to cry. And then you go, I'm in front of all these beautiful people who've kept me sober for all these years. 18 years ago today, I checked myself into Ridgeview. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I think I thought I was going to the spa. And they introduced me to this program several thousand dollars later. And I've probably put several thousand dollars in the basket after all these years, and it's been the best $1 at a time that I've ever had. I can tell you that. It's much more fun to do it $1 at a time. And I can tell you that, really, where'd you go? Beautiful. Absolutely right. God did this. I didn't do this. And I didn't have a real fun time saying that word either when I first came in. And my life is incredibly full and beautiful, and I owe it every bit of that to you guys and the things that you've taught me how to be an adult and how to stand straight and tall and proud and sober, and I appreciate them.
On that broad highway.